Available now from fxphd.com, all new speed grade fast forward training. Download immediately all 10 classes and footage covering CS6 speed grade. Check it out at fxphd.com. Hi, I'm Mike Seymour, and welcome to this week's VFX show. Man, you're going to want to have three hands for this one. We're doing the film Total Recall, the reboot of the Total Recall, or have I been here before? I don't know. Matt Wallen, how are you, sir?
Excellent.
And we also have Jason Diamond. How are you, sir?
Excellent. Thank you.
So I'm back in Australia, but I saw this in the USA, and I enjoyed it, but let me start, as we do, with a bit of a film review from the guys and what they thought on the film generally, and then we'll swing around to the visual effects, which actually had some really, I think, some really interesting work and certainly some great combination of live action and practical effects. But, Matt, why don't we start with you? Did you like this one more than the Schwarzenegger one?
No. Although I did, you know, I did go back and watch the Schwarzenegger one, not for the show, but maybe 6 or 7 months ago. I remember sitting down and watching it, and I remember thinking like it hadn't aged very well in terms of the production value. I remember seeing it in the theater as a kid and thinking the Verhoeven Schwarzenegger version and thinking that, wow, this is it was pretty fun. Schwarzenegger kind of hits all the right notes in a movie like that where he, you know, has his absurd one-liners, you know, the considerate divorce and his, get your ass to Mars kind of stuff. And it was just fun, you know, it was completely ridiculous and over the top. Watching it again, it didn't hold up as well. And then for a host of reasons that we can go into if we want to touch a little bit on the previous version, which I think we'll probably have to some degree. And then this film, I wasn't really super excited about seeing it, although I did think that the first trailer that I saw was kind of compelling, but it really felt like there were some changes to the story, but I felt like they didn't really break any really significant new ground. And it kind of felt just sort of unnecessary. While there were some great effects in it, I thought, I could have not seen it, and I don't think my life would have been any less rich.
Yeah, it's a difficult problem, isn't it? You reboot a franchise, you really have a problem. If you redo a film, you really have a problem. There are some films that were French films that have been redone in English that I thought were very close to the original, and I thought, yeah, that's fine. That's, you know, I understand an audience not wanting to see a French film because it's foreign language. That's going to reduce its box office. I get that. Maybe it shouldn't, but it obviously does. In the case of Spider-Man, it wasn't like a shot-for-shot reconstruction. There have been some famous flop shot-for-shot reconstructions, Psycho being one of them. This one seemed to fall a little in the middle. It was a little bit of like a reboot, but also felt very much like the same kind of plot points. And unfortunately, I think the first one had a bit more humor and a couple more twists that we sort of didn't get in this one. And so while this was grittier and whatever, it kind of lacked that slight tongue-in-cheek. What was it, Johnny Cab? And just like there was just tons of little things in there that were kind of joy.
Sure, sure.
This one was all a bit sort of serious. And because you know where it was going, it lost, you know, I mean, there are other films by the same writer, which obviously this is based on a short story.
Philip K. Dick.
Yeah. And and I think, what was the one that Tom Cruise was in? You know,
Minority Report.
Yeah.
Minority Report.
So that was like
his most famous one, Blade Runner.
Yeah, but I was going to say Minority Report is like this in the sense that it's kind of gritty and doesn't have a lot of humor in it, but I didn't know where it was going, so I kind of enjoyed that film. This one was kind of gritty and didn't have a lot of humor in it, and I knew exactly where it was going, so I think that took some of it out of it. But what about for you, Jason?
I agree with both of you. Also, a recent Philip K. Dick film from a short story, The Adjustment Bureau, which also fell very short. You know, it's a the Total Recall is, or We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, the short story, is a 15-page short story. The Schwarzenegger one, which I love, even though it's cheesy, it's a Schwarzenegger film, so it's allowed to be cheesy, right? So, you know, in the short story, they don't go to bars, but they decided to do that in the original movie, which totally works. And I think these guys, like Len Wiseman thought, the director, well, we're staying closer to the original material, so, you know, it's a reimagining. But to make it about civil unrest between the last two basically civilized areas of Earth, I don't know. It really didn't come together for me. And honestly, Matt, you said it. They used two of the main sort of taglines from the first movie. They used the 2 weeks, right? From the first one, when Schwarzenegger sneaks into Mars and he has the fat woman costume, yep, on in the head, and they're like, "How long are you here for?" And she glitches on 2 weeks, 2 weeks. It was really funny. And in this one, they had a woman who looked exactly like her front and center of the frame when she walks up to the little passport thing, and they go, "Hi, ma'am, how long are you here for?" And she goes, 2 weeks. They're like, "Oh, that's really funny. That's great." And then, of course, it's not her. It's the Asian guy behind her who's Colin Farrell. And in this one, the entire third act, my brother and I, after a fight scene between Colin Farrell and Kate Beckinsale, would say to each other, "Consider that a divorce. Consider that a divorce." They never used it. Like, they're too good for that line. But every other little, like, the three boobs was the other one, rather. The press releases beforehand. "Nerds, chill out. We're going to have three boobs. Don't you worry." Like, I'm sorry. It's not going to make me go see the movie. And if you didn't have it, I really wouldn't care. I'm more upset that there's no Quado, personally.
Exactly. That was point, yeah. Because it lacked any particular plot point that you couldn't see coming a mile off. But it was really well executed. And I do have a monumental, fundamental problem. Well, okay, firstly, I understand why you guys didn't like it as much maybe as I did in some respects, because Australia whipped your ass in the terms of the southern to the northern hemisphere. But leaving that aside for a second, I think that there's just this problem that if you don't go to Mars, and let's face it, if they'd gone to Mars, that would have been a bad move given the spate of Mars disaster box office receipts that we've seen from Mars Needs Mums and John Carter of Mars. So I get that. But really, going through the center of the Earth without anybody kind of addressing the fact that they're going through the center of the Earth? I mean, it's something if they would like had a space elevator that, you know, sci-fi guys would say, well, that is actually, you know, theoretically possible and blah, 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 blah. But they were like, we're going to go through the center of a planet in next to no time, avoiding any issues of, oh, I don't know, the melting at the core of a planet, or just for the matter that you can't really get anything happening in terms of fixing air or anything else. You've got a complete breakdown of almost everything, but you've got one single elevator that's the most complicated piece of tech in the known planet that's all working fine. I mean, I
think they called James Cameron and got a whole heap of unobtainium.
Yeah, it was like, hang on a second. If you're doing I could work it out, but the G's you'd have to pull to have that. And when the thing took off, there was no one being slammed into the ceiling.
They're reading a book.
Yeah, I think you'd have an astronomical number of G's. Like, there's a subsonic plane that's just been that goes six times the speed of sound. I think it's like Mach 6, pulling 6 G's or something that I saw. It was going to take 4 hours to get from Sydney to London. So if you're doing 17 minutes, I hate to think how many G's you'd have to pull. So I sort of almost like, what is that? I almost thought for a second, oh, they're not really going through the center of the planet. That's a fake. And I was like, no, it's not. No, we just completely skipped that. Now, I know I've gone on about physics and stuff, but it just seems such a monumentally weird thing to have as your plot device and so central to the story and never address it in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, it was just like hover cars I'm okay with and stuff, but this seemed – did the lift shaft from hell not bother anybody else? It just seems so odd.
I mean, the design was kind of cool, and I did think some of the effects – in particular, surrounding both the departure of the vehicle or whatever you want to – the building or whatever it was, and then its arrival, some of those huge vista shots of the cityscape I thought were pretty well done. And I thought the magnitude and the scope of those they were pretty epic, you know, and they were well executed. But yeah, the passing through the center of the Earth and the reversal of gravity, while, you know, probably kind of a fun idea if you're, you know, 12 years old, and maybe that's the target audience for this, I don't know, but it just seemed kind of completely ridiculous and like a way to have these kind of, you know, goofy set pieces later on in the film.
Yeah, that's the thing. Oh, we'll have, well, if they fight on the thing because after whatever, then when the gravity reverses, that'll be when he makes his move to switch, turn the tide. And I mean, it seemed like a lot of these things were worked out around the gags and the set pieces. But to be fair, I don't think I've liked a single Len Wiseman film. So
that's being fair.
I'm being honest.
Yeah.
The guy's making hundreds of million-dollar movies left and right, and he's married to Kate Beckinsale. I'm sure he's not going to be upset by me saying I don't like his films. I don't know. There's just something about his films that I don't like, and maybe it's a subject matter. The only thing I do like about his approach is that he does favor as much practical imagery on set as he can get, you know, clearly heavily augmented later, but I would do the same thing because it looks better and it gives you better tracking and better things for objects you're going to replace and what have you.
Is it true that he came out of the props department?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Anyway.
Did he make a director prop one day?
I can understand you can have a zero gravity car and stuff because there's, you know, somebody invents something. It just, to me, the going through the middle of the Earth thing wasn't, and I'm not trying to pretend like this should be a realistic film, but it just made so little sense because we all kind of know that if you fall, like in a vomit comet, if it's just, you know, as it goes down, everything goes to zero gravity. Like it made no sense to me that you'd have normal gravity and then suddenly no gravity and then normal gravity again and no G-force. Like it just, and it's not even a visual effects thing, it's just like, was like, what are you doing? That this was so wrong, so odd, so stupid. And yet the rest of the film didn't sort of treat the audience with quite the same disdain, except for the fact that the president can go one-on-one with what seemed to be a CIA operative in the way that no other baddie could for as long, or even a killer robot could.
Right.
Because I don't know about you, but my prime minister is not really known for her kung fu martial arts, and most politicians aren't. So, but
it is Mr. White. I mean, you know,
okay.
Yeah, come on.
Okay, so leave that all aside for a second. Move now to the visual effects, and I loved the environments. I mean, I just thought that the digital environments, those shots, the big wide shots, both the London stuff and the, I'm going to call it Australia stuff, the New Colony stuff, you know, where mm-hmm. you've got the chase sequence that happens when he first goes one-on-one with his wife, and they're running around, jumping over bits of stuff like the rooftop, if it was a traditional film, a rooftop chase sequence. Great stuff. The stuff, you know, lovely tracking around high up in the new, the English side, and its integration with things like Big Ben and stuff into the kind of background. It was just like a good sci-fi set. It was everything you wanted from sci-fi. I just hoped and prayed that that level of authenticity and that level of kind of great sci-fi thinking would have actually made it through to more of the script.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's tons of practical sets in that chase, which was great.
Yeah.
I mean, 90% of, except for backgrounds and vistas, you know, through windows and nooks and crannies of the city design. You know, that was a lot of set building, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, it did feel a little setty in places, especially down near the water, but that wasn't the case at the other side of the planet. I thought that looked just spot on. And I've got to say, the other thing I thought worked really, really well, and we should probably start with this in terms of a detailed discussion, is the hover car chase stuff. Because, again, it's not as if we haven't seen hover cars before. And in the Tom Cruise film, in Minority Report, we had sort of something mm-hmm. kind of similar. But these were done really by somebody trying. I mean, whether this is coming from the director, I guess it is, but this whole idea of shooting the hover cars as actually car sort of models, the life-size kind of rigs on top of what is effectively life-size go-karts that are driving them around on a road. In other words, you're filming big fiberglass hover cars sitting on top of practical specialist cars, and you're swerving and you've got multiple cars in shot. Lent to just fabulous footage. I mean, it just looked great. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I would totally agree. I mean, I think that stuff worked so well using those rigs. I'm sure there was also a number of digital vehicles as well in certain shots, but I mean, I thought it was really successful. You got, you know, great interplay off of the windscreen, as well as, you know, being able to see the actors, you know, actually reacting to what was happening around them. And I think, you know, that combination, like you were saying, Jason, of the practical with the digital environments, I mean, really helped sell those shots in a way that you don't see as often anymore. It was reminiscent, I thought, the chase scene of I think it's in, is it Attack of the Clones, or where they have the big chase at the beginning where they're driving through the city? Is that, it's sort of, it was reminiscent of that, although I thought it came together much better than it did in Attack of the Clones. It was sort of like, you know, they had the practical vehicles in that as well, and, you know, combined it with a huge digital background, right, of the city. And in this case, I thought it was much more successful because it felt like there was something a little bit more believable in terms of sort of the physics of what was going on.
Can I ask you a question about this, Matt? I do think that it looked great, and I think it was successful, but they're trying for this level of realism, and they're doing it very successfully with the cars. Do you think that the somewhat stylized grade, because it was pretty monochromatic, that sequence, yeah, they really sort of just went down to like almost a duotone sort of bluey palette. Do you think that's fighting against the realism? Because it sort of made it look stylized because the grade was so heavy-handed and strong. Or do you think for an audience like this, it doesn't matter, the cooler shot, the better?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great comment. You know, that's a really interesting insight. I don't know that I personally noticed the grade during that sequence. So for me, it didn't really, you know, pull me out of that moment. You know, I think you said it really well, Mike, earlier on when you said that, you know, and this is sort of a blanket comment, and not to speak, you know, in a derogatory way about the effects in particular in any way, but just to say that, you know, no matter how good some of those effects were, I think, when you said that the script wasn't strong enough to really, you know, propel the rest of it forward, like it was hard to feel that there was ever any real peril or to care that much. And I think that took away somewhat from some of the action set pieces in that it just never really felt like it mattered that much.
Yes, it was very hard to get emotionally attached to anyone because they didn't really ever let you think that anyone that you cared about was going to ever get that hurt. That was just going to be like the, and you kind of know that with the hero, but yeah, if there'd been a bit more at stake.
I think the best metaphor for how this compares to the original is when Tim Burton remade Willy Wonka. We went to see it, and the whole time I'm just singing the songs where the songs should have been because there's no songs. And it's just, that's what it feels like. Like, you know what's going to happen, even though it's a slightly different plot. You get it, and you're sort of like, oh, I know it's going to work out. They're not going to kill, it's not an Aronofsky movie. He's not going to kill Colin Farrell at the end in some weird way that's going to make you go, oh, wow, that was crazy, you know, or Tom Tykwer. When it, you know, it's not an indie movie. It's a couple hundred million dollar film. So it's the set pieces that really they have to work around to just make it work. Personally, my favorite, and we'll get to it, I hope, my favorite set piece action scene was the elevators.
I was going to say that because the cubes, yeah. That seemed to me to be the other original piece of the...
That was great.
And I would say this, if you were to take this and not call it Total Recall and come up with a different ending and a different story and build more from what you got in the car chase and the elevator, so I didn't know what was happening because it was a new story, I'd probably be sitting a different tune right now because I had no problem with the visual effects overall, though I did a bit of a problem with this grade. And I thought that the action sequences were terrific. It's just the other bits in between the action sequences, in between the visual effects... I totally knew what was going to happen, and it wasn't that sort of dramatic. So yeah, you got a taste of a different movie in those two sequences. So let's discuss those elevators. I mean, there are a couple of instances. I guess Harry Potter is one of them, of elevators going sideways, but it made for a good sequence, I thought. Jason, you want to lead off on this?
Yeah, I really liked it. It actually also had a little bit of a Toy Story 2 suitcase
yes.
Chase thing. But, I mean, that's a classic sequence. It was also in the first end of the first or the whatever, the droid factory in one of the Star Wars prequels. It's a classic move, and it's fine because it totally works. You're like trying to get from A to B, and there's even a shot where they stop short before one of the elevators comes, and it's a wide profile shot that's almost identical to Luke and Leia trying before he shoots his harpoon gun to swing across the expanse, you know. But again, these are visual quotes that anybody would make. I thought the execution was great. I had no idea what was going to happen. And there's, you know, the elevators closing and cutting robots in half and people dropping in through the top and having to catch them sideways and upways and slantways and sideways for a Willy Wonka thing, for the Wonkavator. It's, I thought it was executed really nicely. I really liked it.
Yeah, because, I mean, again, because you didn't know what was going to happen, it made it, I think, a more engaging sequence. And it was well played out, and there was, you know, lots of good threats. I remember in one of the Mad Max films hearing the director talk about the idea of having a threat. In this case, it was the bomb on the attached to the inside of the elevator. In the Mad Max, it was a car coming at the opposite direction at the car that they were on, trying to pick up a bullet or rather a shotgun pellet to, you know, kill somebody that's trying to kill you. You've got like multiple ways that you're going to die here, and you play with the audience as to which one they're focused on, well, not forgetting that the other one's about to happen, and you can, you know, cut really well. And I do think this sequence benefited immensely from good editing. It's a good sequence. It's fun. I don't know that that the visual effects did anything but deliver exactly what they should have done. There are a couple of times that I was sort of mildly curious about some of the mechanics of it, but it was, you know, it was a good sell in terms of providing a good sequence. But I want to discuss, if I can now, the more technically elaborate incident that happens at Recall when he first becomes aware that he's a secret agent, or depending on what your point of view is. That is a bit of the elephant in the room. Do you object to the fact that this one was so unambiguous with its ending?
I mean, I kept thinking they were going to come back, you know, one more time with some sort of ambiguity as to whether or not, like, is it real or is he, you know, in the chair? And I was a little disappointed that in the end, like, you know, it's real, you know, like he's a total badass or whatever. And that was kind of disappointing. I was sort of hoping for more of the, you know, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of like, because it felt like there were elements of that, you know, sort of laid along, you know, breadcrumbs like in the original, kind of laid along throughout the story. And there were so many great opportunities to go back and do that. And that would almost have given it a kind of levity that I think it was lacking.
I think.
Well, also, they tried to ape the sequence from the first movie where the psychologist comes in to tell him he's having a psychotic break, and Schwarzenegger sees him sweating, and that gives away the fact that, you know, in your mind, the guy wouldn't sweat. Yeah. And they tried to do that this time with Bokeem Woodbine, his friend, come in and talk to him, and they let Jessica Biel turn that one over by crying. But it just was like, you knew that scene. As soon as they started that scene, you're like, oh, this is the scene where they try to convince him
that she's going to sweat or she's
going to... Yeah, something's going to happen, and you're like, all right. And to me, that... I never thought that it wasn't real.
Okay, give me a camera and one microphone, and let me have like 10 minutes with the principals, and I reckon you could have made this a better film. And you know what shot I would have added? The end credits, because I sat through expecting this, right at the very end, you know, like it goes through all the credits.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whatever it is kebab scene with the Avengers that I didn't get to see. You just hear on a black screen, honey, wake up, wake up. And his eyes open to see his wife looking at the screen, and that's it, cut to black, right? And it would have added just that whole, like, it could have been after the main credits. So most people have left the cinema, and you would have been like, yes, that was like my, you know, well, hang on, Why was huh? And it would have been great, but yeah, I think they choked.
Can I just say one thing that I think is incredible about the way we've been conditioned now with post credits scenes? That after the first like main, there was no like fancy credit design, so like the first main credits are going by, and I said to my brother, "Oh, hold on a second, we were like gonna bail in the middle of the credits." And we're sort of standing in the aisle, and then one of this lady walks over who's probably like 60, who's an usher, and the first thing she says to us is, "There ain't nothing after the credits." And I was like, "Holy crap, that's insane. That's amazing that she just immediately picked up that we were waiting for some sort of post-credit gotcha."
But wouldn't that have been the time to do it? Just you could have put a great ambiguous shot in there that people would have been kicking themselves that they didn't hang around for, that could have brought into question so much. Okay, let's go back. So I'm saying the scene where theoretically he doesn't know whether he's just been injected or not, and he jumps out of his chair. We have what is probably the most visually interesting, technically accomplished scene, which I think draws into sort of focus all of our three collective talents, because it was a bit of an editing design, direction, shot design, and physical camera trick. So let's start with you, Jason. You know what I'm referring to, right?
Yeah.
Just describe to us what they were. Well, did you like the shot when you saw it, and then how did they do it?
I actually really liked that shot, and I had seen it. I had watched a bunch of behind-the-scenes stuff before I saw the movie, because I kind of was on the fence whether I was going to see it or not. And because I knew the story, nothing was going to give it away for me, like unlike a Dark Knight or something like that. So my brother and I were watching this behind-the-scenes stuff, and we saw before I even saw the shot, I think you saw part of it in the trailer. We saw the making of that shot, and I was like, all right, now I want to see that scene. And so, like you said, it's the scene where he jumps out of the chair and he takes out the 7 or 8 UFB or whatever they're called, government guys, and then is like, oh shit, I'm a badass. So it's a physical camera move that whips on these what looks like little sort of eased keyframes in the corners if it was a CG camera, but there's real dolly track. Was it a doggy sled or what did they call it?
A Doggy Cam Systems is the company
doggy
that makes
cam,
it.
Yeah. So they had and also I want to point out that, because we didn't bring it up yet, this is the first big budget sci-fi action film shot on the Epic in 2D. Because everything else prior to this on the Epic is all 3D. Hobbit, Spider-Man, Prometheus, or comedies like Adam Sandler or whatever. But in terms of like these big, you know, the big movies that Red wants out with their cameras, this is the first 2D one and anamorphic. And because they wanted to shoot anamorphic is why we have anamorphic in our cameras, because they had to write the firmware for them and then everyone else just gets it. So they have, was it 4 cameras on the doggy sleds? So they had the doggy sleds lined up in their moves, and they all overlap by about 2 feet so that they can get up to speed as they come around their corners or whatever they do, so that the cameras can sort of hand off the move, and then they stitch it later with some clean plates they shot with a regular dolly and obviously a lot of compositing.
Yeah, so Doggy Cam Systems is the company that makes it. The bit of kit they use is what's called the power slide. And the power slide comes in like 4 or 6 foot length, so you can string a few of them together. And the idea of it is that you basically have a system that allows you to get up to speed very, very quickly on an as you'd imagine, a powered slider rig. But because the rigs are carbon fiber, the actual rails, as it were, it's very, very rigid. And so you can control these things and just fly up and down. But the second thing that makes this system work really well is it can either be overslung or underslung, meaning that if you wanted to have one track come along and the next one pick up from it and move out, and you couldn't undersling one, what would happen is you'd have a big gap, right? Because the physical apparatus would mean the lens would never get, you know, right to off the end of the track to match up with the next one's start position. You'd have a gap. And I guess you could sort of maybe interpolate and optically flow between those two gaps. But the trick of having the undersling and oversling is that the first one comes in, if you like to think of it, upright, as in overslung. And you can get another lens to almost exactly the same position by having the next one not sitting on the same plane, but underslung, so its track effectively can overlap where the other track's was. Now, of course, if you ran them together, you'd smash the two lenses. But if you do it carefully and just tweak them, you can get a pickup from one to the next. And that pickup does need a little bit of work, but it does mean you can do these massively, which is kind of, I guess the effect, Matt, visually was a bit like sort of bullet time, but without the super, super slow-mo kind of aspects.
Yeah, and, you know, I definitely thought it was neat in that it was like something that felt, you know, fresh as a visual style, something I felt like I hadn't seen before. But I don't know that I would say that I felt like it was sort of perfected. I think there were moments where, I don't know if it was the transition between the different cameras or when it would do a really sharp, almost like a 90-degree type turn really quickly to sort of follow with the action. There were moments where it was doing that where, for me, it felt kind of herky-jerky. Like I was conscious of the camera on a rig, you know. And it was great choreography. You know, I think they said it took them like, what was it, like 20 or 30 takes or something to get that timing just right, the Colin Farrell, the actor in the fight scene. And it was a great effect. I just think it's one of those things that, like, I it would have been cool to see more of that, because then I think it would have developed a more of a visual style in the film that could have been something that maybe would have given me a little bit more to sink my teeth into with this picture overall. But it was really just that one. It felt like it was kind of one off. It was just that one shot. And then that.
See, I disagree. I think that it was brilliant that they only used it on that one shot, because for me, and I don't want to be argumentative, but it just seemed to me like this is exactly what you want. You want the guy to suddenly experience the world differently. So audience are going to suddenly experience the world differently. And it marked, but when it stopped, you had a same reaction that he did, which was, oh my God, what just happened? Which is his sort of reaction of, oh my God, what did I just do? And for the audience, we got sort of a visual underlining of an emotional response. I thought it was exactly what you wanted. And then I would have say, again, sorry to sound argumentative, bravo for not overusing it, because I don't know, there was another point in the story that maybe at the end when he sort of decides and he's about to be injected and he's, you know, strapped to the chair and his friend comes in as one of the cops and he breaks free. Maybe then, but it was about only one other place I think that I would have.
Or in the sweat scene or something too, where it's
sweat
like
scene, yep.
He's sort of being questioned about who to trust and like sort of the confusion and the sort of, you know, trying to make that decision, you know, the heightened sense of
but that's, you know, it, isn't it? He had this sudden moment. Heightened sense
the camera,
of awareness.
The camera path, motion path, felt like a bit like a carnival ride, like a
roller coaster,
Well, where it goes, you know, where carnival rides where they spin and they go out and they have like that brief second of tug where you're
and
sort of waiting and
it
snaps back the other way.
Yeah, I'd agree. Not a roller coaster, but one of those jerky rides where you kind of.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. Yep.
Yeah.
It swings.
I still liked it. It worked. For me, it was probably one of the better physical executions in the film.
This rig can move at 3 feet a second. So I guess a real advantage was, notwithstanding the weight of the lens, that you actually had a lightweight camera, because the momentum of stopping that rig and accelerating up is going to be a direct result of how heavy the camera rig is. I dare say the Epic really helped you quite a lot in terms of that. Well,
did you see that? I'm assuming you saw the pictures of the rig, because they're also on pan tilt heads. The anamorphic Panavision anamorphics are almost bigger than the camera.
Bigger than the camera body, yeah.
Yeah. All glass, no ass.
Yeah. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, me too, my friend. okay, so I think whether we should have used it more than once or not, it was a win. I'm going to say another really good win was how they did the synths. Now, these robots are a common problem. We've seen it in iRobot and other places where you, obviously Star Wars, where you had, you know, huge clone armies. And the solution you normally go to is just to put them all in CG, for after all, we don't want them to look particularly human. You don't have a uncanny valley problem. And yet here they tended to get guys in suits and then sort of effectively remove bits of the guys so they felt no longer like a guy in a suit, because clearly their waist was ridiculously small or their elbows weren't there and there were some cables there instead. And I think, again, just want to applaud that, because it gave the physicality to the interactions that you would not get from a CG character. But also, I felt they looked, just on screen, remarkably good. They felt both real and robotic. You guys?
Yeah, I would agree. It was reminiscent, I thought, too, design-wise, as well as sort of the effectiveness of them on screen. It reminded me of that, I think it's a Neil Blomkamp short film, where it's an eval robot in Soweta or something like that. Have you guys ever seen that short?
The one where he's in the office taking the job?
It's like a police robot. And no, not the one where he's in the office, but it's like a police robot. Like, I think it was the Embassy Visual Effects had done this piece, and I think it was Neil Blomkamp's film. But it's like a robotic police officer. We can maybe have it in the show notes or something. But it was reminiscent of that, which was really kind of a neat, effective use of sort of a robotic police character. And it was much better than the overall effect of using both sort of the real head and torso of an actor and then replacing, like you say, sort of that midriff and some of the joints and whatnot. It was much more effective than, I think, the look of the robots in something like the Will Smith movie I, Robot. I thought what they achieved in this was, it worked better. I know it was a different design conceit in I, Robot, and I think they were going for something maybe a bit more emotive than these were, because these didn't have any sort of real facial expressions. But I thought they worked really well.
I liked it. I didn't actually – I think they sort of melted in for me, that I didn't even actually – they just felt like guys in suits, which you want, because that's sort of what they're supposed to be. It wasn't even until halfway through that I was like, oh, you know, in certain shots, oh, you can see through them or other things. And it still didn't even make me say, oh, they're not, there's clearly CG, a lot of CG going on. I just thought it blended in nicely. But can I just say, if someone punches a robot one more time and doesn't break their hand and not be able to use it for the rest of the movie, I'm going to kill somebody. Because it's like, why would you think to punch even a guy in a motorcycle helmet in the helmet?
Can I actually do an aside here, just on two things, like a bit of a rat hole, so my apologies to you listeners, but they're technical rat holes. I went to an awesome lecture at SIDGRAPH last week, and we previewed it because I knew it was going to be good, on physics for animators. Now, for those of you that regularly listen to the show, you'll know this is right up my bloody alley. And I was caught out by how remarkably good this lecture was and how much it taught me about stuff that I didn't know. And I was smug enough to think I knew quite a lot about this subject. And it relates to this film in two ways. Firstly, that punch. And this guy, it was like a whole afternoon session, and we've got a coverage on FX Guide. In fact, we did a preview interview with him, but he held up, he had this poor guy who was his assistant. I mean, this was not a comedy act, but you'd think it almost was. He held up this giant steel spike. I mean, like, this is the sort of thing that if you had it in a movie or a horror movie, you'd be like, this is going straight through the eye, coming out the back of the head, and this is, you know, going to get an R rating for this film. It was like a vicious-looking spike. And he gets his guy up on stage, and he holds up a tile on his chest, and he hits the tile with a hammer onto the end of this spike, and it shatters the tile. And then he says, now I'm going to do it without the tile, exactly the same. Now, if you saw that, at this point, what are you thinking?
Right, he's going to stab himself.
Yeah, I mean, you would, right? I mean, I thought. And he holds it up to this guy's chest, and where are the audience laughing like he's not really going to do it? And he does it, and it doesn't hurt the guy one iota. And he pointed out this is a Houdini, literally Houdini, not the program, the actual guy Houdini trick, that because of the nature of inertia and give, if you do it on the guy's chest muscle, the muscle gives. So there's no harm done, right? Like the spike does not break anything. If you did it on the chap's skull, it would crack his skull as it did the tile because it has all the inertia stopping instantaneously. That's why the tile cracks, which is why your point about the punching is so relevant, right? You punch an object that has no give, your hand will crack. If you punch a guy in the chest or in the face with give, you'll have a punch-up. And this guy had a whole lot of these, and it was just magical to watch this physics guy from University of San Diego. And all of it was about how to animate stuff. And the next one, which, again, it sort of relates to a part we covered in an FX Guide story that Ian Fales wrote for us on the site, is about the fall, like the actual, lift when it basically gets destroyed at the end of the film, and the speed at which it fell. And again, I offer this by way of conversation, but he held up he had a video of two balls, and he said, I've scaled the videos so that the balls are the same size, and they in the videos, because he scaled the video so the balls were the same size, they were similarly off the deck the same amount, which was about one ball height. Does that make sense? So you just got a shot of a ball, clearly one ball height off the deck. And he says, if I drop these, will they kind of hit the deck at the same time? And of course, what would you guys say, Matt?
Sure.
Yeah, that's what I said. Yeah.
No, I would say no, because you scale it up so you have no point of reference of how big the second one is.
But hang on, doesn't a feather and a hammer drop at the same rate on the moon, drop at the same speed?
Do they?
Yeah, because Newton was right.
Okay, but in fact, Jason's right, and Matt, you and I are wrong, because... Mm. He was saying, if you're dropping a tennis ball, and this ball on the left, which I couldn't tell what it was the size of a tennis ball, it would hit in three frames. The height of the ball, three frames. If it's a bowling ball, which it was on the camera left or the other side, it'll take six frames. The simple reason is, as Jason pointed out, if you scale the pitches, the distance they travel is bigger. In one case, it's the height of a tennis ball, which is like 3 inches, I guess. And the other case, it's a billiard ball, which is the height of like 6 inches. And it takes longer to move, even though the mass is irrelevant. It's just moving those physical distances is different, which is, of course, why we can gauge scale by how things move in terms of speed or something. We're just so programmed that in this sequence, which I'm talking about, the destruction sequence, they had to keep on slowing down the rate that things fell because it wasn't looking epic enough or big enough. And even though things fall at the same speed, you can slow things down in a blow up a lift sequence. And all it's going to do to a point is make everything look bigger. At some point, of course, then goes into slow-mo. But I just thought it was really fascinating in reading Ian's article that he wrote, how they were talking about that they got everything right in Houdini and everything was totally right in real world sense, but they just then had to go in and scale it, quote, to make it look big and they had to artificially slow it down. And it is kind of fascinating that, like, I think it's easy to be, as certainly as I have been, somewhat pious about getting the physics right. But in fact, you might be thinking you're getting the physics right and you're actually getting it wrong. And certainly these guys had, in that explosion sequence, I think, really convincing physics, even though, according to them, Houdini said it would move a lot faster. I mean, swinging back
But that's because you can use theoretical math to say that based on these given variables, X should happen. But if you've never actually seen something like that happen, then you actually have no idea what it should look like, right? Outside of what your math tells you, which while it may be physically correct based on what they found, they still had to scale the sense of it so that it would feel correct to the senses, regardless of the actual math. Just like we were talking about in The Dark Knight Returns when the bridges blow up. Like, you know, that looked insanely accurate, or the explosions under the city when they all go off at once and you're in this high wide from a helicopter and you see little puffs of smoke, because that's what you would see. You wouldn't see a giant fireball from explosives, you know, that far underground that are just meant to disrupt and move walls.
I totally agree with you. I just also think, though, doesn't this make our jobs just, and those of us that do visual effects, just the best jobs ever, that you get reason to try and understand the world better? Like, think about it. Like, we've been discussing optics. We've been discussing, you know, characteristics of scale, speed, lighting. Like, it's as you get the tools getting better and better, It isn't just a matter of obviously handing them over to the programs to do stuff. We'd never suggest that for a second. But also, to get it to work right, as an artist, you just need to have increasingly a much, much better understanding of the world around you to be able to get this stuff to look right. And I love that it pushes us to understand this stuff.
I think, Mike, you and I had the same conversation when we did the 2012 show, the Roland Emmerich movie, when we talked about the destruction of the buildings and how the animators basically had to become structural engineers to decide and figure out how to not even specifically pre-break stuff, but for the procedural aspects to make them look accurate. And so all of a sudden they're like sub-architects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've heard of people going out and filming stuff. And a good example of this was the Avengers talk at SIGGRAPH. Again, they went out and they filmed a bunch of stuff, people being thrown around, and they had just for little things, right? Like Iron Man comes into land after being knocked by Thor, and he just sort of falls and recoils against a log. It's not a big sequence in any way, shape, or form. It's like a tiny shot. You'd never notice it normally. He's digitally just sort of thrown to the ground, and he sort of skids and falls. And they did a character animation. They did it. They got out and they just started filming people doing stuff, and then they looked at reference of a guy coming off a mountain bike, and just pummeling down a hill. And they were like, oh, well, that looks like a ragdoll. And they started doing it as a ragdoll sim, and then they just sort of built out from there. And you'd be thinking that a shot like this would be not a C shot, because obviously it's a completely animated Iron Man, but, you know, it's certainly not the shot that you're, you know, putting on your reel. And yet every time they did an iteration and then they showed additional reference, the shot got better. And it got better because of the powers of observation, not because it was really wrong to start with. I mean, yes, some of it was maybe not as heroic from a directorial point of view, but most of it wasn't. Most of it was just somebody sitting there taking the trouble to analyze stuff, think of new reference that might be pertinent, and then sort of add it back into the equation. And I love hearing artists do that. I just think it's like one of the best parts of the industry. And if you can film anything and get it as reference, it's just the best way to go.
Yeah, totally.
Matt, you must do that with your guys and stuff, and certainly done it in your career, I'm sure. Just shoot stuff on like an iPhone or a mini DV or whatever it was in the day. Just totally.
I mean, so many examples of that I can think of back, you know, in working at ILM or at ESC, we did a bunch of stuff like that. And Tippett Studio, we would do that. I mean, even I've had students do that in class, you know. I mean, there's that old kind of, that was one of the great things. I was in that talk too on the Avengers at SIGGRAPH, and that was one of the things I thought was so great when they were discussing, in particular, animation, was really addressing specifics about performance and believability. And that idea, I always joke with my students and say, you know, that animators are the most vain people you'll ever meet because they all have mirrors on their desks because they stare at themselves all day long, right? But the joke being, right, that they're, you know, a lot of times you'll have a mirror on your desk because you want to know what shapes you need to make certain sounds for mouth shape or whatever. But oftentimes you'll see people getting up and, you know, enacting some sort of interaction in order to get a sense of what it feels like and what it looks like. And the animation supervisor, his name escapes me at the moment, but on Avengers was talking about that very thing and how you know, that's what they were doing, was going out and reenacting stuff. Or if it's not reenacting something or filming something, you know, it might be setting up, you know, some kind of a simulation in order to get, you know, the desired look or effect and to really understand how something works and why things, you know, behave the way they do when they're collapsing or, you know, or when water flows through them or what have you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this.
So there's really, I mean, there's nothing better than real world reference for anything. I mean, all my friends in the business, I mean, and you guys probably have the same thing. It's like there are so many times where, you know, some goofy video that you see one day on the internet, everybody starts passing it around for no other reason than it's just like, oh, this is amazing reference. You know, you got to have this in your library as something that you can go back and look at, you know, for, you know, lava or for, you know, fire or whatever it might be.
I totally agree. And I guess the other thing I learned from that physics class is even when you think you know it, just get more reference anyway. I mean, another one that he did was he had this assistant guy of his standing, talking to him with 1 foot on one scale and 1 foot on another scale to show transfer of weight, which, of course, we all know that there's transfer of weight as you're standing and you don't stand symmetrically. You tend to lean on 1 foot on the other. But he just kept the conversation going. Then he'd heat up the conversation. Then he'd calm the conversation down. And depending on how the conversation was going, even the guy that wasn't talking would rapidly or slow down his weight transfer. But the weight transfer was off the dial. Like at points, it was completely on one foot or the other, even though he's meant to be standing still. And just watching this and watching the scales in real time, graphing that weight transfer and understanding what the hip movements were doing to facilitate that, that kind of stuff. I think you know stuff, or you think you, I certainly think I know stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you see it and you go, wow, that's even more than I thought. So yeah, reference.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I think we've covered the big beats. Is there any sequences that sort of you maybe were a little disappointed in? And I should point out, Zgraf umpteen supervisors and people came up and took me to task on this section of the VFX show because they're like, man, you just, the guys from John Carter, you just the green screen shots. And you, I was like, okay, whatever. So with the greatest of respect for the people listening that obviously worked at this at places like DNEG and the Senate and Booth and MPC and Prime Focus, I don't know if I missed anyone, Base Black, with the greatest respect to the double negative team or whoever it is, any shots that didn't work for you guys?
I think most of my stuff was stylistic stuff for the style of the film, like when he goes to the whatever red light district, techie red light district he's supposed to be in to find recall, and that's where the three boob chick comes in, and then you see people getting these like cool electronic tattoos that like glow, and you're like, God, if I ever see another like tribal tattoo thing to indicate alternative primitive modern primitive culture, I'm gonna throw up in my popcorn. It's just I don't know who makes those decisions.
Wouldn't it be nice if they were doing doing retro tattoos of brands from the 80s, right? Or something.
Yes. Yeah.
Like
I much preferred the Minority Report part, you know, one where Tom Cruise is walking down the hallway of the mall and it's like they're doing retinal scans and saying, oh, Mr. So-and-so, the chinos you like are in store now or on sale or whatever.
Yes.
I think also from a design standpoint, clearly they were referencing Blade Runner, although almost everybody does mm-hmm. at this point with a rainy, gray, you know, neon city. But the city itself, the Australian city, new colony or whatever, looked very procedural to me. Like it looked like somebody taught Sid Mead how to use procedural animation because it had that vibe, but then it was like a ton of cubes, which may be practical yep. for the way people were living, but it seemed just very geometric. And again, that's just my own personal taste of what I would like. I'm not saying that's not functional
now,
if you really broke it down to living quarters and what have you. Because inside their apartment, they had like, you know, like the corner of a cube jutting through like their living room, which broke it off from the kitchen. And so it's certainly the design sense flowed through into the interior living space. But I don't know, it was more that stuff that I was paying attention to. I think for the most part, all the CG and compositing and whatever was done really well. Like at no point was I like, oh, that's clearly a blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean?
Are you aware that they use the City Engine software to mm-hmm, procedurally mm-hmm. generate the cities? Yeah, it's an architectural tool.
Yeah, I read that. The other day after but I had seen the movie a while back, 2 weeks ago or something.
I think DNEG pretty much has the building scape stuff nailed out of what they were doing for Inception, right? I mean, the ability to generate streets and cities, they do a spectacular job of. I sort of know what you mean about the procedural thing, and by the same token, I did actually really like the level of detail and the complexity and the vastness of those wide establishing shots, but hey. Anything?
Well, no. They were executed well. It was just the design,
yeah.
Not the execution.
The only thing I'd say though is I've seen loads of I don't know what do you call them in England. In China they'll have these rows and rows of basically council flats, for want of a better thing, or council buildings, and they are so repetitious and so ridiculously. Because they're sort of hard to get much variation when you have big structures. I mean, at ground level, you get lots of variation, but once they start to go up, it's just really the architecture. And as they tend to cookie cutter them and repeat them, you get a procedural in real life sense of multiple buildings at a distance, especially away from the individual window trimmings and stuff. And it looks fake in real life, if that makes sense. But hey, valid point. Matt, what about you?
Yeah, you know, I just saw the film today. I did not go rush out and see this movie until the day we were going to do this recording. So it's still pretty fresh in my mind. And, you know, I was one of maybe, I think, four people in the theater, which maybe doesn't bode well for box office, although it is a, Wednesday today? You know, there was nothing that really stood out. I mean, I was really – I appreciate that comment that you say supervisors come up to you and say, oh, man, you really gave those guys a pass on this, that, and the other. I do appreciate that comment. I think that's actually pretty valid statement. But, you know, with this film, I didn't – there wasn't anything that really stuck out as being, like bad lighting or bad comp or bad render. I mean, I thought the city stuff, you know and the city engine stuff, I thought it just – it looked great. I thought it looked really, really cool, and I thought establishing those environments and that – establishing that world on that grand scale was really successful. The only stuff, you know, where maybe at times it just felt a tiny bit muddy would just be, you know, where you had the actors in almost, you know, I would imagine pretty large CG environments – like in the elevator sequence, but I mean, you know, it's like really nitpicking, looking for stuff to criticize in that. And nothing really stood out to me at the time where there weren't any like classic, you know, window interiors or something in a moving vehicle or something like that. You know, I felt like it all seemed to have a really cohesive aesthetic that seemed successful. And I think, you know, that's credit to the individual vendors and to sort of the QC, you know, that went on with the studio supervisor too. I think, you know, being able to make sure that everything's coming in and looking right and looking consistent. And I just think there was nothing that really jutted out at me. Did you? What about you, Mike? Did you see anything?
The only thing that sort of bothered me a bit is there were some set pieces that felt like they could have been more CG and be more accurate. For example, they went down to the train that took them to the Badlands effectively near the end of the film. And that subway, to me, felt like a New York subway. It didn't feel like a tube station. I've been in lots of tube stations. That didn't feel like a tube station. It felt
definitely
like
New York. That was like the A train.
Yeah. And I was like, well, this is meant to be London, and the tube is iconic. It's not like I just happen to ride it a lot. I'm an Australian, and I know intimately what that kind of feels like. I assume that was a build, but I've got to say the entire pipeline of D-Neg got overhauled, and we went into a story on this with Philippe Leprince, who's head of lighting and rendering at D-Neg, and there are three films that have just come out, Dark Knight being one of the other ones, where they've used this entirely new RenderMan 16 plausible lighting, plausible shading model, which is producing, I think, just such photoreal stuff that I'm kind of stumped when I look at a D-Neg shot to know where the set stopped and the sky the digital started, except for if you've got a contained space that doesn't seem to have much shoot off, I assume it's in a studio because it feels more studio-ish. And I think the lighting and the train sequence, that whole bit of them getting in the train and going out to the Badlands, just all felt to me much more like somebody had spent a lot of money on a set, and it really probably could have been done better or perhaps more authentically. But probably that's as much an art direction criticism as a visual effects one. I actually would recommend that podcast with Philippe Prince, because he gets pretty geeky in talking about the pipeline. In fact, we're doing that a lot at the moment with the FX podcast, which is going to get really deep and provide heavy-duty, hardcore technical stuff in that podcast for those of you that are into that stuff. And for me, I don't know what you guys think, but I mean, it's like photorealistic exteriors tick. If you've got a really good team like this, you can't pick it. It's just really a good solved problem. Not easy to solve, but it's solved.
Yeah, yeah, I would totally agree.
Execution, that's the thing with a lot of these movies, is the execution is generally on point. It's an element. It's a design issue. It's an art direction issue. You know what I mean? Like, we're at the point now where if a shot is bad, it's just something just went wrong and it just slipped through the cracks, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the scale of doing this, you know, it might seem that we're saying it's trivial, and I'm not. I'm not saying it's trivial for a second. But if you get an A-grade facility on a problem like this that has a really good, you know, team, and you get the A-team of your facility, then you are going to get results that are just indistinguishable. My only criticism then, as I said earlier in the show, is if you start grading them in a very stylized fashion, I think that fights a little bit against the realism of what you're trying to pull off. And, of course, it's pretty cool these days to have a stylized look, and I think the color palette of that car sequence in particular was really hitting stylized level, which, again, do I care? I guess not, but it's fighting a little against realism. Well, look, that's it for this week's show. Thank you so much, everyone, for being with us. We have a bunch
I ask a question, a rat hole question?
You bet.
So Seagraph just happened last week, and there's one thing I just wanted to ask you about, Mike, and it might be interesting for people to hear some thoughts on it, but there was a talk that was given that was led by Doug Trumbull and Dennis Muren and a sort of a cadre of other luminaries on high frame rate cinema.
Were you in that session?
I was, yeah.
And isn't it great you can go to something like Seagraph and actually see that with your own eyes?
Because, oh my God, yes. Yeah.
I don't know where else in the world you get a chance to see that. That was just that really made – because a couple of things like that just really make a difference to just following stuff on the net. It's like, I cannot experience this unless I am in an environment. And pushing, I'd seen 48 frames, I think I said on the show earlier, at Red. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, you know, high frame rate stereo, but I'd never seen 120 frames. And I certainly hadn't seen a test at the level of detail that this one that Jim Cameron presented was at. I mean, it was phenomenal. Though my only criticism is, oh my God, couldn't they have split that into two panels? Like, everyone got to have, like, one tiny brief chat. I'd have Dennis Muren talk solo for the entire duration that they gave him, like, you know, what, 3 or 4 minutes on, because they had so many good people on the stage.
Well, and I thought the sensitivity with which both Trumbull and Muren talked about sort of their interests in exploring high frame rate cinema and what they thought it would be good for and what maybe it wouldn't necessarily be as good for, and that, you know, that was really interesting. And Dennis Muren told a really interesting story about watching, I think, the Harryhausen, the Seven Voyages of Sinbad on his big screen TV and playing with the refresh rate and going back and, like, watching this traditional stop motion animated film, this classic film that, you know, he grew up loving, and watching it sort of interpolated on his TV and feeling like he was getting, like, more frames, you know, than were actually shot in the movie. And so he got kind of excited about this idea of being able to go back and look at something and explore the idea of higher frame rate cinema. And I thought it was a really interesting story. I had a couple of issues with the presentation that I just kind of wanted to ask you about. Like, one, I thought, you know, there's a lot of real sort of hyperbolic language. Like, James Cameron narrated all the footage that we saw, and I guess he shot a bunch of that, right? And he kept saying that, you know, things about how this looks terrible and it's unusable in a film. You would never use it. You know, the traditional sort of 24 frame rate stuff. And the only thing I thought that was really weird about looking at stuff at a higher frame rate, it felt like some of the more traditional, you know, tropes of cinema, like, you know, a dolly shot or a pan or whatever, all of a sudden at, you know, really high frame rates, I thought some of the tracking shots, like where the, you know, the camera's on tracks and it's sort of dollying behind this table, which is, it was this medieval scene and, you know, not anything of grand consequence, but it was made to look like, you know, a real movie set. And they were tracking behind this table of all these people eating around this table in these medieval costumes, and they're all gesticulating and there's candles and whatnot. And as the camera moved at 24 frames per second, you could see like strobing and stuff like that in the foreground. But at the higher frame rates, the one thing that I noticed that I thought was really sort of distracting was that all of a sudden the idea of a dolly shot became something that felt really different at a high frame rate. It felt like contrived in a way, because you became really conscious of even the very high frequency, minute movements of the camera on the dolly rig. So like could be like, the camera's beginning to move now. Like, the camera has hit a bump, you know, the camera's slowing down. And so the realism was heightened not only in what you saw on screen, but it was also heightened in your sense of awareness of the presence of a camera. Did you?
That is a really astute observation. I had not articulated that. I now know what you mean when I sort of think back, but I wasn't as perceptive to articulate that.
Think that like it would be great, you know, high frame rate cinema or high frame rate, you know, photography, cinematography would be fantastic, you know, for sporting events. But when it comes, it almost made me think that if we're going to have high frame rate cinema, which, you know, I'd be up for seeing it, I guess, you know, it's certainly looked interesting without a doubt, but it almost seemed like it would call for a different set of, almost like the tropes of cinema would have to change somewhat. You'd have to have a different set of procedures or ways of in which you would bring the camera into the environment. It almost felt like, you know, to have the camera move less or to move maybe in a different way would be more interesting. Like to try to do it in a more traditional cinematic way, you know, the kind of the softness, the motion blur, you know, that you'd see at 24 frames per second, I think removes this sense of the consciousness of the artifice of cinema. And it felt like you were really, the artifice was stripped away at that higher frame rate. It was so real that like it almost became, like it didn't feel like some of the magic was gone in a way in that, well, it's more real. You know what I'm saying?
I wasn't there, but from listening to you talk, what it seems like you're saying or is saying is that at a 24 frames, you're seeing a new world, right? That's being created by camera movement and production and what have you. At the higher frame rate, because it looks more real, you never see that kind of, like, you don't walk down the street on a skateboard. You know what I mean? You don't slowly slide and watch in slow dolly moves. You don't stand up slowly behind a table to look at somebody. So all of a sudden you're feeling like you're in the real world. So why is the camera doing what I don't do as a person? Right? Like my eyes don't do this.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I mean, I guess that was the thing that I noticed more than anything else in seeing this. And it'll be fun, I think, for everybody, you know, listening to the show, like when The Hobbit comes out, like if you have the opportunity to see it at the higher frame rate, to see, you know, does it work? Like, does it work in that way? Like, and, you know, do you have, or is it, does it just completely work? It's magical. You still feel the same, you know, kind of joy and excitement that you'd feel in a regular, you know, cinema. Or what I saw, like, is that something that, you know, other people perceive of? I'd be really curious to hear that.
There was a bit that Jim Cameron said that just summed it all up for me. He said, see, in this shot now, it looks more like reality, less like a movie. And for me, this was like the quintessential point of the entire exercise. If you want it to look like a movie that you know as a movie, then you won't do this. And if you want to go for something different that's immersive, that, you know, a different experience, then you would really like to do it because it's more real, more immersive, generally less between you and the action. So I think in 3D, it's completely valid because I've already lost the whole movie experience of watching Die Hard as a kid when I'm in a 3D cinema with glasses on with stereoscopic. I mean, that's just – plus, you know, modern stocks are so clean and blah, blah, blah. So I just feel like, okay, that's a different experience. That's an immersive experience. I put the glasses on. I go into the world. This film that we just saw was trying to look more cinematic in a Die Hard-y kind of sense. It had the lens flares. It was shot anamorphically. Would it have benefited from being in 48? I don't think so. I think it would have been difficult. But I will say this. I really want to just point out that the elephant in the room for me on this is just the amount of bloody work we're talking about, because Jim Cameron's made all these sort of stupid comments, I think they're stupid anyway, about how it's not going to be that much more work. But if you take a normal film at 2K at 24 frames a second and just think about this for a second compared to one of these things that we're talking about, you go from 2K to 4K. Well, that's right there, four times the surface area. Yep. Theoretically, you have to do much better roto because everything's much more precise. So that's a lot more work. Now you go to stereo. Well, they've got a left and right eye. Well, I have to get the roto really good because it's got to work in stereo and can't, you know, it's not like it automatically gets happening. Yes, there are some tools, but no, generally speaking, it doesn't all automatically get solved. So now I've quadrupled the work. Then I doubled it. Now we're at 8 times. Now I only got 48 frames a second. Well, I'm going to double it again. Now we're at 16 times the amount of work. I'm sorry, like, if anyone thinks that you're going to roto 48 frame a second 4K stereo in anywhere near the amount of time that you would roto, you know, 2K, and at the same SIDGRAPH conference, Roger Deakins was speaking. Terrific.
Oh, yeah, that was
love
great.
Roger Deakins. Awesome. But I stood up and asked him, hey, how do you tell about green screen, like, you know, lighting? Because, you know, I wanted to sort of hear maybe his approach to lighting to a background and how much it had to match and stuff like that. And instead of that, which I hoped I'd get but didn't think I would necessarily get as an answer, he was told a really great story about how on Jarhead he was doing something with Pablo Hellman, and basically what happened is, to cut a very long story short, he would have had to have had a massive green screen put in for a handheld shot which moved from facing north to facing south in the same one take as somebody sort of walked around the camera. And so Pablo said, hey, don't worry about it. And he's like, what? He said, don't worry about it. Don't, just do whatever you want to do. And he's like, what, now or for the rest of my career? And so this long story finished with Roger Deakins joking that when he's on set now and someone says, yeah, I want to put a green screen up and do this, he's like, well, Pablo said...
Yeah, Pablo could do it.
Yeah. And this was this sort of implicit.
Yeah, that was great. And where else but at SIGGRAPH are you ever going to get a chance to see, Paul DeBevec get up and ask a question of Roger Deakins in a session?
Yes.
It was so cool.
What did he ask him?
I don't remember.
It
now.
Was a question.
Do you
about,
remember, Mike?
Yeah, I think it was a question about lighting tools. Did he feel he needed better lighting tools to light digitally, where there's a need for more tools? And my thing was, say yes, because Paul will invent it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, please articulate something that ICT will then, like, research and solve. But my point was, at the same conference, you've got someone basically saying, we're going to fix it in post, and this is one of the best cinematographers in the world. And then you've got the filmmakers kind of saying, yeah, you want to up the levels. And I'm sitting there with a bunch of guys that are all – you know, in the trenches as much as they are in management, sort of solving these problems. And I'm thinking, could somebody please address the issue of exactly how we can do all this extra work?
Well, there was a guy in the high frame rate cinema. I can't remember his name now either, but he was a technician, a gentleman from Weta, who got up and spoke, sort of gave a little bit of a dry presentation, but he did get up and speak about the pipeline issues that were confronting Weta, in particular on The Hobbit, with, you know, shooting at a high frame rate at a larger resolution, and what some of those issues were, and that those were really the primary concerns in a post-production workflow. And I thought that was good that, you know, they had somebody on the panel to speak to those issues and to raise those concerns, because it was just, you know, it was more informational than it was anything else, although, you know, Cameron's narration was very much like a, you know, a pitch to try to get more and more people to shoot this way, I thought. So I do think that was something that, you know, people definitely were taken into account anyway.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I thought it was a really good session and totally enjoyed it. I enjoyed hearing these different points of view. But I just feel like there was just, you know, there's a sort of a feeling that technology is going to solve problems, and technology certainly enhances it. I just feel like maybe, you know, in a race to create new problems for ourselves or have technology solve those problems, that we're not necessarily catching up with technology. There was a gap there a while ago. The gap, if anything, is just still there as we move forward. Yes, we've got better tools, but the challenges are now bigger, harder, denser. And I don't know that we're now, you know, tremendously, because, you know, there's just a lot of grunt work, as we all know, on a film. Like, and it's not that it's mindless grunt work. It's hard slog with intelligent people doing intelligent jobs, but it's hard work. There's just no two ways around it. That's, I guess, my only thing. Like, it's just that it does come at a price. I mean, you jack up your frame rates to 120 frames a second. I don't care that you can easily down res it to 24. Somebody's going to want to see it at 120, and that's going to require a lot of work, even if most of that work gets thrown away when it gets dropped back down to 24 or 30 frames a second to go out to television.
Yeah.
We must finish up there because we're running out of time, but thank you so much, everybody, for listening, and thanks for that diversion, Matt, because it was a good conference.
Yeah, thanks for indulging my SIGGRAPH rat hole.
No. It's great. Love doing it. Jason, thank you for being with us. You... in New York again. And what's the best place for people to follow you or track you down or on the Twitters?
The Twitters is Jason Diamond, one word, or the site with my brother for our co-direction, the Diamond Bros, BROS.com.
And we're about to publish something on your awesome Cookie Man video over at FX Guide, so check that out as well. And
thanks.
Thanks for that. And Matt, what about you?
I'm starting up August 23rd here, back for the fall 2012 semester at Virginia Commonwealth University School of the Arts in Richmond, Virginia. And you can always find me on Twitter at Matt Wallen or mattwallen.com.
And, of course, I'm at FX Guide or on Twitter as Mike Seymour. Thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it. Until next time, see ya.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.